things were said to make me. Every Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population, until recently when domestic violence and war have taken its toll on women and children, women were 50% of the population. We are less now, but we still are 53% of eligible U.S. voters. Every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in the social, political, and economic arenas, because we are not a special interest group. The views and opinions expressed on Every Woman are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KKFI staff, management board, underwriters, or sponsors, or other volunteers of KKFI and Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated. Hi, I'm Sharon Lockhart. On the board today is trainee Craig LeBeau, and we have in the studio one of our latest cohorts, Marvita Oliver, and Ann Pritchett, who is also an associate programmer on Every Woman. And our guest today is Erin Gould, with an advocate, a parent advocate with Game On in Kansas for the school district, and she's here to talk to us about what's going on in Kansas. More of what's the matter with Kansas, I guess. But first, we're going to have news that Marvita has recorded. I believe we're ready to go with that, Craig. Is that in Powell?
Google employees in over 20 countries are bringing awareness to gender discrimination after Google CFO Ruth Porat was addressed as, quote, the lady CFO, end quote, by a shareholder at last week's annual meeting. In a campaign titled, quote, Lady Day, end quote, Google employees, both men and women, are changing their job descriptions to add the word lady in front of it. Quote, I wanted to do something fun and googly that allowed us all to stand together and to show that someone's gender is entirely irrelevant to how they do their job, end quote, said Meg Mason, lady partner operations manager, shopping. According to a study published in the Lancet Medical Journal on Friday, millions of transgender people around the world face significant barriers to obtaining adequate health care despite an increased risk of major illnesses, including HIV and depression. Some of the challenges to gender people are exacerbated by official government policies that discriminate. Over 17 European states still force transgender people to undergo sterilization before they are recognized as their gender identity. Finally, published in the Feminist Current on Monday, June 13th, public officials, citizens, and feminists are wondering why the Orlando shooting happened. Questions include, what can be done to prevent it in the future? Is it a case of Islamic extremism, poor gun control laws, American homophobia, or toxic masculinity? With no easy answers, the Orlando shooter shares characteristics with other mass shooters who demonstrate very clear patterns of male violence, including alleged domestic violence against his wife. Many are using this incident to highlight the need for stricter gun control, while others place the blame squarely on Islamism. Hashtags like hashtag love wins and hashtag love is love started trending as a way for people across the world to show solidarity with those affected by the Orlando shooting and the LGBT community at large. A general theme emerged expressing love will triumph over violence, urging people to spread love, not hate. As the world grieves, it is natural to seek explanations for what happened and look for ways to prevent similar incidences from happening in the future. Unfortunately, however, it will take more than vaguely spreading love to change the world. It will take fighting for tangible improvements.
Thank you, Marvita, for reading the news for us today and recording it. And now we're going to get started with our chat with Erin Gould, a parent advocate for Game On Kansas, with Ann Pritchett, an advocate for teachers and educator in the Kansas City, Missouri School District, an activist, and with Marvita and myself. Welcome, Erin, to Every Woman.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
We were chatting quite a bit before the show about how you got involved with Game On as a parent advocate and how long. I think you said March of 2015?
That's correct.
And the Game On's been in existence since about, what, 2012?
I think that's about right. Mm-hmm. Isn't that terrible that I don't actually know? I was inspired by Heather Ousley when she walked to Topeka, and they started posting on Facebook about her walks. And in the early part of 2015, I must have just felt like I needed a really long walk or had a new pair of tennis shoes or something, because I thought that would be a really great idea. And I recruited my seventh grade son, Ian, to come with me. And we ended up walking two of the 3 days. We were planning to walk all three, but then he ended up being invited to attend the state geography bee. So we had a really active weekend, and we did the geography bee, and then we walked the last two legs, about 42 miles from Kansas City to Topeka, and it was an amazing experience.
And that walk has grown considerably. Yeah, the people that have joined in.
There were three legs this year, weren't there?
They were. They had. They came from three different directions into Topeka. And I think at the time in 2015, they were really hoping to get 7,000 likes on their Facebook page. And now they're at last look, which was I think yesterday, over 12,500. Which means that's 12,500 like-minded people in the state of Kansas who care deeply about the state of Kansas schools.
And can you tell us what is wrong with Kansas schools?
Well, money, 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 yeah. Taxes, money, taxes.
Yeah, you know, that's a tricky question. And I found that I get asked trick questions a lot about schools lately. The state of Kansas schools is actually something to be really proud of. Mm-hmm. I think our teachers and school boards do an amazing job with incredibly slim resources. That said, the problem is, as Ann said, it's to do with money and resources, and it has been a long, long fight. I've been trying very hard to educate myself on how did we get ourselves into this place, and I cannot say that I can answer the question with any real authority. But it does come down to the will that we have as a society to fund our schools adequately and equitably. And truth be told, Kansas is a difficult state because we have urban areas and rural areas, and they have different economic requirements to get the similar education to their children.
Erin, I don't have a child in Kansas school right now, and but I do want to know, what is Game On? What is that all about, and why are you so involved in it?
Well, Game On for Kansas Schools is a nonpartisan grassroots effort that was started by some local parents who were very concerned about things that they saw happening in Topeka. And they got together and they started keeping up with the information that was coming out of Topeka and disseminating it. And there are two names that I particularly admire. One is Judith Deedy, and she's the sort of executive director, head honcho, inspirational woman who really has become deeply educated on the history of funding in Kansas schools, and she takes her show on the road, and she speaks to people all across the state, groups that are interested in understanding how Kansas schools got to the state that they're in, and she does it for free, and she's amazing. And the other woman that truly inspired me to get actually off my couch and into the game was Heather Ousley, and her husband Jared is actually now a House representative. You know, she has a normal life. She's got small children, kids in elementary school, and she was fed up, and she walked to Topeka the first time. She did it in, I think, pretty uncomfortable weather.
With just a few people, too.
Pretty much was on her own the first year, as I understand it, and she is a total inspiration, and these two women have built a group of people, and isn't that terrible? I don't even know. I can't name all the other really wonderful people that are responsible for developing Game On. But it is this group that really works hard to build bridges and communicate with school districts and other concerned groups across the state to make and to follow what's going on in Kansas schools and to make sure that people like me who are interested but don't really know how to get involved, that we have a way to get involved and that we have a way to get information that makes sense to us, because reading legislation is really hard and I don't do it well. I've tried. So it's great to have well-trained people, both Judith and Heather are attorneys, to be able to say, this is what this really means. And then to be able to say, and this is how it affects you personally.
Right.
And this is how it affects your children. And this is how it impacts other kids. Because it's important to remember that while Heather and Judith both live here in the Kansas City area, their concern is for all children across the state. I think the biggest thing is that Game On for Kansas Schools is much bigger than just Shawnee Mission or Olathe or Blue Valley or Kansas City. We've taken the show, they've taken the show across the state and have done an amazing job advocating for our children.
That sounds really involved. So, and you represent teachers in Shawnee Mission.
Well, I just live there. I wouldn't claim to represent them.
Well, as a teacher.
I can speak as a teacher, yeah.
You know about Game On. What do you think about the organization and how have you seen it impacting what you do?
Well, historically in education, real change has always come from parents and not from educators and not from administrators and certainly never from politicians. So when I first heard about the group and learned that it was mostly parents, I was very thrilled because I knew that this was, they're going to have some power. But when you look at special education legislation, for one thing, I tell people that because that's my field, and I tell my young teachers I mentor all the time that we're not here because some administrators 50 years ago decided it wasn't fair that we weren't educating all children, including those with disabilities. That's not what happened. It was their parents who said, wait a minute, my children should have rights to the same education as everyone else. And after about a 10-year battle, they accomplished legislation at the federal level, which impacts a lot of what we do in our public schools today. So it was parents that brought it about, and that's where the real change is. And I think that's where most of the passion is. And I'm a parent too, so I can think on both sides of my brain on this issue. And but as teachers, you know, that we don't have that same, we have a sense of ownership, but not the same that parents have. So, yeah, I'm really thrilled with their work, and I think it looks like a good organization. And Jared Owsley, it just inspired me so much when he turned right around and ran for the state legislature, because how many people, Sharon, have you and I met over the years that we've been friends who are upset or concerned about an issue, but they didn't turn around and run for office? And I'm not criticizing those people, because I'm one of those who has not volunteered to run for office, because I know how much work is involved, but it's really inspirational, and he's one of our go-to spokespeople in Johnson County, which is great.
Well, he's so dedicated that I think the year that we walked, he was actually walking to Topeka, you know, with Heather and the group, and I think he was walking on at least one broken heel. I mean, he was like physically incredibly injured and still made the walk, and they're incredibly inspirational people, and parents, all of them parents.
And basically, this is because there's not enough money, so the state says, to keep the schools funded the way they need to be funded. And another sort of jarring note, tell about the woman who said to you, tell that story.
Okay, so one of the ways that I've been able to help Game On is that I have driven, now it's three times, to Topeka and read testimony that Game On has submitted to twice to the House Education Committee. And then most recently, on Thursday, I presented testimony on behalf of Game On in front of the Joint Judicial Committee, and which was discussing the possibility of amending the Kansas Constitution to make it impossible for the courts to actually cut off the funding and close the schools. And Game On didn't think that was such a great idea, so I drove down there and I spoke. And Game On, as a school advocate group, generally doesn't have a whole lot of friends at the moment in the legislature. And I've been assured many times that nobody's going to ask you questions, Erin, because nobody really wants to hear that you need to put more money in schools. So I was absolutely flummoxed on Thursday when I was recalled after my testimony, not once, but twice, to answer questions. And the first one was the harder question of the two, I thought, and it was from Senator Lynn, and she is in the Johnson.
She's from Olathe, yeah, Gardner area.
Yeah. And she asked me point blank, and another gentleman named Brian Kuntz, who represents another school advocacy group, you know, what's the number? What is the number that it will take for us to stop having this discussion? You know, what's going to be enough money? And she kind of got up on her soapbox and talked about, you know, the billions of dollars we spend, and isn't that enough? And when is it going to be enough? And I don't think we, any of us, want to keep coming back here and doing this. And I guess I just don't think quickly enough on my feet, or I just felt compelled to try to answer the question honestly and not really think of the question as a trick. But it was a tough question to answer, and I have been ruminating on it ever since. And I was told afterwards that it's something of a trick question, because it wasn't really fair, because, you know, I couldn't possibly, as one parent, be able to know the answer to that question. And I think even in my testimony, I sort of deferred to the educators and people on the state's Board of Education, who set the standards and really know what it takes and define what a quality education in Kansas is. And I said, essentially, I don't know the answer to that question. But what I do know, and I told her this too, was that nothing costs what it did even in 2005, which, you know, right, we've been having this sort of ongoing funding battle for well over a decade. And in 2005, when the courts sort of put their foot down and said, you've got to put hundreds of millions of dollars back into the schools, and the legislature actually did sort of try to comply, and for a couple of years they were putting money in. But in 2005, for example, a first class stamp cost 37 cents. And now it costs 47 cents. And so it's one small example, but the prices of everything goes up. And moreover, you know, the composition of the Kansas student has changed somewhat. There are more children living in poverty, and it takes a little bit more to educate those children. And so I don't know that I could possibly answer that question, because I'm not qualified to from an understanding education perspective. And I do not understand all the complexities of the demographics of the children that we're trying to teach. But I do know there are 460,000 children in Kansas that need a quality education, and that it takes money to do that. And it is an unfortunate thing that it takes, you know, billions of dollars to do, and that we have to wait for a long time to see the benefits of that investment. It's not like throwing a couple million dollars at a bridge and saying, look, see, we built a new bridge. You invest in children for the long haul, and it is an expensive prospect, but the alternative is to dismantle the schools.
But that seemed to be a suggestion that she had. She went on to say,
well, she threw out a mention of remote learning digital schools. I can't remember the exact language
she
used.
Tearing down the bricks and mortar?
No, not exactly. But she did sort of imply that at some point, you know, the cost of maintaining brick and mortar schools is, you know, it's not worth it, because there's all these alternative educational avenues, to which is sort of coded language for ways to take money out of the public sector and give it to other private enterprises and let them be in charge of education, with the theory being that they can somehow do it more economically. But I don't believe, and I think it's the position of other school advocates, believe that they haven't really proven themselves to be able to do so. And that, you know, public schools, public education is sort of like the last big pot of untouched money.
Exactly.
And there are the problem, you know, and in fact, one of the testimonies that I gave earlier in the year was for a House bill that would increase the tax credit scholarship for private schooling. So basically what that meant is that you could get a tax break if you gave money to these private schools through an intermediary. But the point was that the money was going to come out of the same fund that funds public schools. And the problem is that the schools that they're talking about giving this money to are not held to the same standards as that we hold our public
schools. Many of them aren't held to any standards.
Or any start. And then there's been proposals to let people take their money if they are foster parents and homeschool their children. Well, there again, I've got nothing, intellectually, I have no reason to say that a person who homeschools couldn't do a good job if they had both times and means and educational background to do it themselves. However, if you're going to use tax dollars to do that, you need to prove that you are, in fact, using those dollars for how they were intended, which is to provide a quality, suitable, I think is the word in the Kansas Constitution, a suitable education that will serve the state of Kansas. And as a parent, not speaking necessarily for Game On, serving the Kansas students and providing a suitable education means that you've created a student, a person, a citizen that will understand what it means and how to be a good citizen and look out for the interests of the state of Kansas going forward. They have to have a high quality education. They have to be able to read, write, do math. They have to be able to think for themselves. They have to be able to compare and contrast different arguments of things. It's a complicated process to provide a suitable education and to be able to say, well, you can just take your dollars and, we trust you to provide that suitable education without any sort of oversight. That's not how I personally want my tax dollars spent. And I believe there are a lot of people that agree with me. But for those who think that too much money is spent on schools, it's a way for them to keep their money or make money even.
If I was asked that question, and I get asked that question a lot being in the business, how much would it take? Here's your answer. I want enough money that my child isn't sitting a class of 30. I want enough money that my school has a full-time librarian. I want enough money that all of the children with various needs, that we can guarantee that those needs are met in my children's school. That's the answer. It's up to them to come up with the numbers. But they play so many numbers games. The one I think that shocks me the most is when they say that school funding has gone up. It hasn't. They're redistributing it differently. Right. It used to be that we get a certain amount of money from the federal government for special education, for example. I think that the Obama administration has increased it to around 20%. It was 16 or 17% forever. Of the cost that it takes to educate those children, that percent of it comes from the federal government. Well, the federal government used to give that money to the in Kansas, there's all kinds of cooperative agencies serving those children, because in a small district, it's too expensive to duplicate the services that the district 30 miles down the road also has. So they have cooperatives. Well, it used to be the money went directly to the cooperatives from the feds to the state to the cooperatives. Now the state gives that money to school districts, who then have to turn around and write a check for the exact same amount to the special ed agency. Well, so that's not an increase. Sure, they're getting more money. And they did the same thing with CAPERS funding. Mm-hmm. Instead of it going directly to CAPERS, it's going to the school districts, and they have to write a check. And I'd say the majority of our politicians in Topeka who don't agree with us on this issue will cite over and over how much the money has gone up, and they cite the figures that include the CAPERS money and Title I money the same way. They've just changed the way they write the check, but the money itself hasn't changed.
And they understand that.
Oh, of course they do. This is a game they're playing. And then the other thing I think that we all need to remember is that none of this is unaffordable. What's unaffordable is the way we've chosen to allocate the money that we do have, and most especially at the federal level, but even at the state level. The money is there. And if we, for example, if they reinstated the tax cuts, we wouldn't even be having this conversation.
So this does go back to even political decision-making that was done by who voted who into the office.
Yeah.
I mean, because it was pretty much known what the candidates' stances were on budget cuts. And so I have a few friends who are teachers. What in the world are you thinking about? What are Kansas teachers thinking about as they go into a new school season, not knowing whether or not they're going to be funded, not knowing whether or not
they don't
have
know
a
if
job.
They're going to get paychecks this summer. Because summer, you know, you have to realize the money that we're paid over the summer we earn during the school year, they take our salary and spread it out over 12 months. Some districts give the teachers the option of taking it over my district or 9 or 10 months. My district doesn't do that anymore, but we used to. And then other districts give the teachers of getting a lump sum payment on June 30th, which would cover them until their next paycheck, which was probably sometime in September. And those teachers are very concerned because many of the smaller districts have told them, you know, that money's not there. They depend on state funding. They depend on a deposit June the 30th to make payroll in July. And that money, if it's not there, they can't make payroll. Now, some of them can. Some of them have reserve funds that will cover. But how long are they going to have to do that? So I say the money is there. They're just playing games with it. And because I've seen that. I've taught in Missouri my whole career, and I've seen it in Missouri. Because we have this same fight over there. I don't think it's as desperate right now, but they have a funding formula that they've never once met in all the years I've been teaching. And then they'll come out and brag and say, oh, we fully funded the formula. Well, no, you didn't. Because, they use funny math and different numbers and figures to make people think that they're doing full funding when they're really not.
There is, I think, at the foundation a sort of a funny issue where, as parents, we're being told we can't fund the schools properly. And yet, you know, they have this big tax cut in place, and it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to say we don't have enough money to fund the schools, but then we have enough money that we can give these people over here a tax break. And the really ironic part about it is the people who've been given the tax break, many of them have come out and say we don't deserve this tax break. We want the money to be taxed so that we can fund our schools properly. Because in the end, you know, public education is a service that serves us all. And it costs way more to underfund our children in the terms of, like...
Yes, in the long run.
In the long run, you know, a child that can't read by the third grade, they're much more likely to end up in juvenile detention. They're much more likely to be on unemployment or in jails, and that costs a lot more.
We do have a caller. Whoops, we lost that caller. They might want to call back.
It's probably my fault. I'm a bit of a rambler.
Oh, no. And call that number back if you would like to get on the air and make a comment. That's 816-931-5534. Marvita, did you have something you wanted to say?
Nope.
You asked me about teachers. The other thing is that... a lot of teachers I know have withdrawn their applications because we hop across the state line. If you retire from one district, you can go work for another and get a full salary at your new district, plus collect your retirement. It's a little perk. And I know a lot of teachers who are no longer looking in Kansas. We have a two-state area here. We have a lot of choices.
I did have another question. I was wondering, so now that we're having this emergency session to vote on whether or not these funds are going to show up, where have we heard any news about that session and where things are at this point?
No. On Thursday, what they were talking, that the sessions that I was attending, was talking about whether or not to amend Section 6 of the Kansas Constitution, which is the one that requires the state to provide a suitable education. And at the end of it, it turned out that the House and the Senate committee, they had to vote separately, and they couldn't agree. And so something like $50,000 was spent, or $90,000. I think it's $45,000
a day. But somebody today pointed out that you have to subtract the reps who are not showing up, because a lot of the ones who are not running for re-election have opted out of attending the special session. They're done.
Well, these were just representatives from the Judiciary Committee. So I don't know that the dollars are necessarily correct, but the whole point is all of these people were brought in. Many people, you know, drove across the state to come give testimony. And in the end, they couldn't even decide whether or not they wanted to do the thing that they had proposed, that they were all there to discuss. You know, it was a divided. And the idea is ridiculous, right? The idea is to make it so that they can't actually, that the Supreme Court doesn't have the power to do the one thing that it's empowered
that it's supposed to do.
You know, it's sort of like, well, we're going to change the rules because we don't like the rules, mm-hmm. which is, you know, it offends my sense of fair play. But then the special session itself is really to address, you know, the funding part of it. They have to figure out a way to satisfy the Supreme Court. And they'll talk about it, well, it's only 1% of the budget because it's, you know, $38 million out of $3.8 billion or whatever. But it doesn't really matter. If it's not fair, it's not fair.
Exactly.
So
will there be a plan B? We have a caller.
Oh.
Can you tell us your first name and what part of town you're calling from?
This is David, Midtown, and everybody knows me. But, you know, we have to have an educated citizenry to have a democracy. So it just, you know, they want to spend money on other things, but I think education should be one of the priorities, guys. Come on.
Exactly. I mean,
you know, but they want to spend money on everything else. And I am not for the privatization. I believe in the neighborhood public school. I mean, I went to Faxon there at 38th and the
it's still open.
You know, and let me say too, you ladies, your discussion this morning is one. Our staff meeting is just lovely. I really enjoyed listening to you guys talk. Okay, that's all I got to say.
Thank you, David. Thank you.
You know, there is a good point. One sometimes wonders if they're trying to wreck democracy because
I don't think they're that smart.
You don't think
I think they're conniving, but I don't think they're that smart.
That abolishing democracy.
However, I think if you look at, you know, most of this legislation is ALEC-inspired legislation. So, you know, you talk about how complicated the bills are. Well, these people who are filing them haven't even written them. And a lot of them admit when you get them in a one-on-one conversation that they haven't even read it. So I don't think if they have to borrow legislation from an advocacy group rather than write their own, I would think, I've never served in office, but I would think that one of the first things you would want to learn how to do would be how to write a bill. Because that's basically your job when you're a state legislator.
And you certainly are obligated to read anything before
you vote
on it.
Yeah, but they don't. And, you know, there's been some ALEC bills submitted, like there were some submitted in Wisconsin last year where they didn't even change the name of the state. They put, like, you know, in parentheses, name of state, and they didn't even put their Wisconsin in there. And I know that I heard they did the same thing in Kansas, but I didn't see that. But
so to a certain extent, it's sort of business as usual for our state representatives as compared to our national representatives and senators. People are do you think that our officials are bluffing? Do you think that we will have to come up with a plan B for parents and students and teachers in Kansas?
Are they going to have that option, though? I mean,
yeah, I don't know that I'm necessarily qualified to answer either.
Yeah,
of those
I don't
questions.
Think I am either, but I'm not sure they're going to be able to give a menu to the Supreme Court. Here's the two things we came up with.
Well, I mean, as far as a plan B, if you don't if you're not funded,
the schools will close. They will close. And that is a definite reality. That's not just people like me who are very biased, obviously, just trying to get people excited. It really will happen.
And then what do people do? Do they have a plan B in the case of the schools actually closing? I mean, it may even be a thing of the schools might close and then maybe open up later, but I think there is, you know.
In Chicago, before the strike in 2012, the teachers union orchestrated child care, and they went and contacted churches and daycares in the areas of each school so the kids would have somewhere to go. And that was one of the success stories that came out of that strike. There were quite a few success stories, but there was a lot of pre-planning. But I don't think we have the time in Kansas to set all that up.
And, you know, and school closures are actually really, really rare. One of the kind of fun and interesting things about actually going and sitting in these committee meetings is there was a really interesting little presentation by one of the researchers who tried to give sort of a recap of, you know, funding fights across the country. And, you know, the long and short is it's like comparing apples to oranges. Kansas issues really don't compare to anybody else's. But she did point out, I think it was New Jersey, that did have a funding issue, and the states did actually order the schools closed.
Yes.
And they were closed for something like 8 days. And I think, you know, if it really came down to that, the public outcry would be so enormous that it would work against those legislators that are trying to underfund the schools. Because, you know, people... It's an enormous inconvenience to not have your schools there for you when you expect them to be there. You know, set aside the ethical issues you would have of, like, not meeting their obligation. You know, people count on their schools to educate their children and
well, and in the summer they feed the federal government provides the funding to feed children at almost every school site. I know in my district it's almost every school site, and they come for lunch every day, and I know that they can also make arrangements to give families food who need it. And if they close the buildings, that service won't be available, and you'll have to find a church in the neighborhood or somebody to pick up that work and continue it. I mean, because if they close them, they'll shut the doors and they can't pay power bills. And
I keep asking the guys in my office. We talk politics a lot. Thankfully, I work with two males that are just amazingly liberally progressive thinkers. When will Brownback have any shame?
I think he's so misguided. Have you ever met him? I've actually talked to him, and he looked over the top of my head the whole time he was talking to me. And I was at his office in Washington, D.C., and there was this vibe there. I don't know what else to describe it. Of he was like the leader or the ruler or they're Justin Bieber or whatever. That was really uncomfortable for me, not being a fan, but I picked up on it right away, and that probably because I wasn't a big fan. But in the 2 or 3 minutes he spoke to me, he just looked right over the top of my head. It was just creepy. I think he is so caught up in his own ideology. And he's such a believer. And this is one of my criticisms of this particular group of legislators. They seem to be more led by what they believe is right rather than what they've seen and they know is right. That's where we get the family values legislation. That's where we get this stupid bathroom nonsense because, oh, it's just not right to let this happen in our bathrooms. Well, that doesn't mean that it is happening. And they're guided by that rather than... as a person who likes to analyze things, I'd want to know, well, have we had any incidents? Have there been any problems? Is there any reason to change the rules that we have in place now? Let's look. And I've actually worked in schools with transgendered children, so I understand that issue. But I just think that they've decided, what should happen rather than what they know will work. And I'm not sure if that's the best way to put it, but it's just an ideologically driven group of people, mostly men, who they're not very nice people.
Well, I should think that at some point embarrassment would overcome him.
You would think.
And because newspapers are putting this out about this Kansas and Brownback.
Well, that's because the media is liberal and biased against him. You know the answer to that.
You said that with a little bit of sarcasm.
Right.
I've actually never met Governor Brownback, and I'm not sure he'd necessarily ever want to meet me. My personal take on it is that it's really like living in a bubble, and you surround yourself with people who either want something from you or want, or who are willing and able to reinforce your idea. And I think that it's unfortunate that he and the people around him have chosen not to take a real good hard look at the numbers and recognize that they made a mistake. And frankly, I would have a lot more respect for all of them if they could stand up and admit their mistake and earnestly try to undo it rather than continue to push forward. It's such a childish approach. Like, no, mommy, I didn't steal those cookies from the cookie jar, but there's crumbs all over your face.
Right,
but it wasn't me. It wasn't me. You know, it's sort of, the writing is on the wall. It's super, super clear that we do not raise enough money to meet our obligations, sweeping continually from the transportation fund. You know, that's like taking all of your savings out of your savings account to pay your electric bill and magically hoping that somehow your savings are going to be replenished without working.
And by the way, I heard just recently that most road projects in Kansas west of I-35 have been canceled.
Yes.
There's a lot going on here. I know my husband and I this morning were talking about how to get to Costco because I-35 is just a mess in Johnson County right now, and I think we're going to end up going to the Midtown one instead. But we see all this road work around us, and I heard just a leaning right guy on the radio just the other day say, look out the window. What do you see? That's Shawnee Mission Parkway, and it's brand new, and they're working on it. And that was all the proof he needed that this story that we've robbed KDOT is not true. Well, yeah, they make this is the population center of the state. More people live in this part of the state. So they're making sure our roads are getting fixed. But you go out to liberal Kansas, or you go out to Larned or Great Bend and see what those roads look like.
Well, and I don't know very much about the Kansas Department of Transportation, but I do know that, you know, they had a schedule for how often roads were supposed to be maintained, and it was something like every 8 years or something like that. And the number I heard, and I don't know if it's entirely true or not, but it was something like every 50 years. And at some point, you just have to take care of the things you have to take care of. And those communities that are out in the rural parts of the state, they are no less worthy of good roads and good schools than we are here in Johnson County. And by dismantling their social fabric, by taking away their schools and taking away their roads, you are guaranteeing that those areas are going to be a hurt to the state, because they will not have what they need.
Thank you, Erin Gould, a parent representative advocate with Game On Kansas, for coming and sharing the issues and the fight that is going on to maintain the public schools in Kansas.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. And Ann Pritchett,
our
advocate, activist, associate programmer, and Marvita Oliver, and to Craig LeBeau for doing the board so well today. And now we're going to go to a spot that we recorded last week with the Social Change Institute from we've got some messages first that we need to play, and then we'll go to the Social Change Institute group 3.
So how's the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, really doing? Now, hearing some candidates for office, you'd think it's wrecking our economy, premiums are skyrocketing, insurance companies are abandoning the program. What are the facts? Radioactive Magazine interviews Stephanie Moore, HHS Regional Director, Region 7. Tune in for an enlightening discussion of the myths and misconceptions surrounding this six-year-old law, the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m.
On the next forum.
The average young person wants to have a purpose. They want to have meaning. ISIS provides a contrasting alternative. Fight for God or live in materialistic hedonism.
Confronting extremist violence, the refugee crisis, and fear. Faith responses. Wednesday evening at 6.
What does my faith say about this?
This is Royce Handy again, the Kansas City intern with the American Friends Service Committee. We're here with group number 3 of our 2016 Social Change Institute, and they're ready to answer questions for you.
First, I'd like to ask you all to step up to the microphone and say your name.
Hello, my name is Hakima Jones, and I'm with the Social Change Institute.
My name is Kennedy King, and I'm with the Social Change Institute.
My name is Demetrius Johnson, and I'm with the Social Change Institute.
I'm Hennessy Lopez, and I'm with the Social Change Institute.
Well, welcome. I think I participated in about 3 of these annual events so far, and I'm always just energized and amazed at the youth that participate in these classes. What have you found to be the best thing so far that you've done in this class?
I got to learn more about, you know, things that, you know, you don't get to hear about every day, and like more like about payday loans and the interest, how high the interest rate is, and how we don't have enough things that impact the youth in an inner city. So
I also learned that, like, we learned how much Black African Americans get every year, with the annual pay that they get with Latinos and white Americans, and I've just seen the difference for every culture and how much that they get every year.
The pay discrimination is rampant.
Yes.
Absolutely. And who else?
For me, being here, I learned that that in our group, we have different people with different opinions on a lot of things. And we also see a lot of things the same. like the mass incarceration in the world. You know, it's a lot of people going to jail for a long time for little petty crimes.
Well, I learned that how back then, like in the 1980 something, the minimum wage was closer to the living wage, unlike in 2013 where there's like 64% differences in the wages from minimum wage and living wages.
That is amazing. I mean, $7.95, is it, or if it's $7.65, I hear that the, and they may be told you, is it more like $18 an hour would be a living wage today if it were keeping up with the minimum wage?
Yes, it would. Like almost. We don't really know, but I think it might will.
You know, this just, when I started working, I worked as a soda jerk and I was paid 50 cents an hour, and I swear to you that 50 cents an hour I could shop on the plaza. No kidding. I didn't have to. I lived at home with my parents, of course, because I was only 16. But honest to Pete, the minimum wage is a blooming crime. You guys got me started here on something. I don't know how the world thinks we can continue as a consumer society when people aren't being paid enough money to buy groceries and pay rent. But somebody here, come help me, stop me from this rant I'm on, and throw out a rant of your own.
The difference between men and women, how much they're paid an hour, is very significant. It's like, it's unbelievable. And in 1960, the men were paid $36,000, and in 2013, women just are now making a little bit more than that.
At the $36,000 average annual wage?
Yeah, in 2013,
women are now up to what men were being paid in 1960?
Yeah.
Wow, I didn't realize that statistic. You guys are learning a lot.
But also to take note on that as well, now it was like when the world was brought up, it was like men had to make all the money and all the women just had to stay at home and cook and clean and take care of the kids. But now it's giving the woman an opportunity to make an annual pay. So like they, like some women are making more than men, but it's like it's still not enough. Like today, in today's world, so.
Right, and it almost takes two people working now to support a family, and people who only have one earner in the family really suffer, I think, unless the man is like a Donald Trump or, you know, some CEO of a large corporation. I hear that healthcare profession, like the insurance company executives, average $17 million a year. That's $8,000 for an hour for a 40-hour week, or $326,000 a week. We just had a guest on Every Woman last week. Can you imagine the unfairness of all of that? You guys are supposed to be telling me what all you're learning. Keep telling me what else have you learned, because you're setting me off here.
Today, the annual you have to live off of is like $11.60, and minimum wage is barely above $8. So it makes it kind of hard for people to live off that. They got to work two or three jobs, and they barely get home to see their children. They can barely attend events and stuff like that. So it's like, it's almost like a crime to treat people like that. I think they should raise it, and that's why you got people protesting against it. So, yeah.
The $15 an hour movement in the fast food industry has had a big push here in the Kansas City area. Who else wants to throw out something? Don't be shy. I hear group number three is two and one combined.
Exactly.
We also learned that men also would likely get paid more than women because of, you know, men are stronger. They're supposed to be stronger. They're supposed to be faster. And, you know, they're supposed to pick up on stuff quicker than females. And, you know, I don't think that's right, but that's just the world that we live in today. And
how do you women feel about that? Notice I'm not calling you girls.
Well, I feel as if, you know, I'm going to make an example out of football. It's women out here that can play football just like a boy. So I feel like if we can do that too, then we should have the same opportunities as men do on certain jobs too, because it's jobs out here like construction that get paid a lot. And women, we don't have jobs like that to get paid the same amount as men do. So I feel like it should be more opportunities as it is for men.
Okay. We were also talking about how it's not enough activities to do with the youth and stuff like that. And that's how people become in gangs and doing stuff that they should not be doing and stuff like that, be introduced to. And we were talking about how it should be more youth groups on the east side of Troost or whatever. So, yeah. So we were thinking about what we can do and why is it like that and stuff like that.
Good.
And also to, you know, back up what she said, I'm 17, so I'm like a part of the youth. So I play a lot of sports, and it's not a lot of, you know, basketball courts that I can go to or soccer fields or even like a little football, play a little football and some, because it's not safe, you know. And they tear everything down, so you can't, you have limited options to go. So sometimes you got to go out of Kansas City to just play a little ball.
Yes, go right ahead.
And I can add some to that too, but it's like, as we try to build our community, it's like we're still knocking it down, because once, as we take a step forward to build something else, we still have the youth community to knock it down. So it's like, as we keep on trying, we get knocked down twice more. So it's like, why keep doing it? But that's why we're here, to try to help the youth and come together as one big old community so we can make a change.
Does anybody want to speak to why do you think that happens? Why are some people destructive?
Okay, I think people are destructive to the things that we get, because some people, like Demetrius said, it's like, you know, when we go out to Overland Park, Kansas, and we're in Missouri, we see that they have nice things. So it's like, we already have bad things, so why not keep on destroying it? That's how some of the youth think. So I think that that's why people do the things that they do, because it's like, we don't have the same opportunities as other youth does. So it's like, they don't care. That's why we're trying to bring them together so they can care.
And to pick off what she said, I think as a community, we're like less appreciative, because we don't usually get a lot of new stuff. So as soon as we do, it's not going to be like something new. So we just going to tear it down and then going to wait like another like 5 years just to build it up. So I think we should come together and just learn to appreciate things more so they can keep, so they can see that, oh, they can take care of stuff, so they can keep building stuff for us. So we have some things to do.
Are you able in your daily lives to influence people? Do you know people who are tearing down things? And do you try to talk to them and tell them that they should not do that?
Oh, yes. I have friends that, you know, some of them just go down the wrong path. And I try to tell them, like, hey, man, we can just, you know, if we act like we're supposed to act, then people wouldn't look at us how they look at us now, you know, because they say a lot of things that's not true. But if we keep doing things that they see we doing, then who are we to tell them it's not true if we're going to keep doing it?
And to connect to why I'm in the Social Change Institute, because I feel like, you know, it's a lot of youth kids that don't take the opportunity as I do. So that's why I'm thinking, like, okay, let me see if I can try to help. If they see that I'm doing it, maybe they might want to gather along and tag along and do what I'm doing to make a change. Because it's like, you can't wake up one day and tell somebody, oh, do this and that. If they see you doing it and it's a positive change, maybe they might tag along and do the same thing. But it's like, we can't just sit up here and we can't just tell them what to do. So it's just like, it's in a lose-lose situation.
This reminds me of be the change you want to see.
Yes.
Be the change. I asked the last group, how many of you think you'd like to participate in a radio show?
All of us.
All of you? Okay.
Yeah, I would like to participate. You know, I'll feel some type of way. I'll feel important, you know, so.
I'll feel like a celebrity.
Oh, who else said that earlier? Yes, you're right. It was Leah.
Sports, like, didn't work out for me, that was always my second option, is to be on a radio talk show with one of my friends.
Oh, we are friends.
Well, I tell you what, you all are invited to become part of Every Woman and we will try to work out something to get you a regular slot on Every Woman. That'll be great.
I have time. We could do that.
What?
Let's do that. Okay.
Okay, now tell your names and what school and when you graduate.
Okay. Well, y'all know, shout out to Crystal Ray. My name is Hakima Jones. I'm class of 2017. Woo woo.
My name is Kennedy King. I go to Crystal Ray, class of 2017. You know, we made it.
Yeah, I'm Demetrius Johnson, and I go to Northeast High School, class of 2017.
And I'm Hennessy Lopez. I'm class of 2019, and I'm from Crystal Ray.
Great. Okay, thank you all.
I come from women who gave up their power. I come from women who gave up their name. And I come from women who know nothing ever stays the same.
Stay tuned for Urban Connections with Donna Wolf, and guess who's coming to Kansas City with MCU.
From women strong as stone, and I come.